Welcome to Cut and Thrust, your podcast for the bloody and sometimes bizarre journey through the Middle Ages. Whether it's dark battles, questionable hygiene, or hair-raising rulers, here you'll get history as it really was, raw and unfiltered. So grab your sword, put on your helmet, and let's dive into the wild world of the past.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of the Battle Merchant Podcast. I'm Hendrik.
And I'm Carmen. Today, we are talking about a topic that changed the world, quite literally, with a bang.
Firearms. More specifically, the evolution of ignition mechanisms from the Middle Ages to the modern era. And it's really fascinating because, how should I put it, this wasn't just a new weapon, it was a complete revolution.
You mean because it ended the Age of Knights?
Among other things, yes. Imagine, in the mid-15th century, the first mechanical matchlocks appear, the so-called serpentine. And suddenly, even good plate armor no longer offered reliable protection. Early handguns could penetrate thinner armor sections at close range, depending on the angle and material.
That's intense. Even the best plate armor couldn't help much anymore.
And it wasn't just the physical effect. Roger Bacon described back in the 13th century what terror the noise and light flashes alone could cause. Think of a medieval battlefield, and then suddenly this thunder, the smoke, the sulfur stench.
For soldiers who only knew swords and crossbows, that must have seemed like witchcraft. Psychological warfare before the term even existed.
And it changed everything. Not just the battles themselves, but also the castles. Heavy artillery especially made the tall, slender walls of the classic Middle Ages vulnerable. They had to build lower, thicker, with bastions. A complete rethinking.
Okay, but how did it work technically? I mean, from the first bang to the rifles we know from the Napoleonic Wars, there are centuries in between.
Exactly. And that's where the three great ignition systems come in. We have the matchlock, then the flint
lock, and then the percussion lock.
Someone did their homework.
Well, for us in reenactment, this is essential. Depending on which era you're portraying, you need the right system. Roughly speaking, 30 Years' War, mainly matchlock. Napoleonic Wars, flintlock was standard. American Civil War, percussion dominated.
And each system was a real innovation. The matchlock, this glowing, slow match that's mechanically lowered into the flash pan. That was the first step. Before that, you had to bring the match to the powder by hand.
Which meant you only had one hand for the gun. Aiming was basically a matter of luck.
Or you needed a second man to hold the match. So the matchlock was a real game changer. Finally, a shooter could aim properly on his own.
But matches have their pitfalls, right?
Exactly. The glowing match gives you away at night. It goes out in the rain, the powder can blow out of the pan. The flintlock solved many of these problems. A flint strikes sparks. No more glowing, no telltale match.
And the percussion lock went even further. All you need is a small percussion cap. Less smoke, faster ignition, more reliable in any weather.
You really know your stuff.
I have to. When you're standing at an event and someone asks why your rifle works differently than your neighbor's, you want to have an answer.
And that's exactly what makes this topic so exciting. It's not just technical history, it's cultural history too. Firearms ended knighthood, revolutionized castle construction, overturned entire social structures.
Gunners suddenly became more important than knights. Specialization instead of nobility.
Precisely, and for anyone interested in this era, whether as a reenactor, collector, or simply a history fan, understanding this development is essential.
So, what are we waiting for? Shall we start with the matchlock?
That's exactly what we're doing. And I promise, it's going to be a blast.
So, the matchlock. the name is brilliant. The lever that holds the match is called the serpentine, because it curves like a snake.
Because it curves like a snake?
And strikes. When you pull the trigger, the serpentine lowers and presses the glowing match into the flash pan. The powder ignites, the flame shoots through the touch hole, and boom, the main charge in the barrel goes off.
A simple mechanism with enormous impact that completely changed the role of the shooter.
Exactly, because suddenly aiming was no longer just a matter of luck. You had control over the weapon and the moment of firing.
And all that as a single person.
Think about it. With early heavy arquebus, you sometimes needed 2 men per shot. With the matchlock, the shooter suddenly had both hands free. He could stabilize the gun, shoulder it, aim.
That was a real efficiency leap. Suddenly, you only needed half as many people for the same firepower.
But, and now come the downsides, the matchlock had massive disadvantages. The match itself was made of twisted hemp or linen fibers, soaked in a sort of, well, saltpeter mixture, so it glowed evenly.
And it had to burn constantly, all the time, whether you were shooting or not.
A musketeer probably needed several meters of match per day, depending on deployment. And it had to be regularly adjusted, so it didn't burn down too far or go out. Imagine, you're standing in a battle line, and every few minutes you have to fiddle with your match.
And what happened when it rained?
That was the nightmare. The match was extremely moisture.
Sensitive! And the powder in the pan even more so.
In rain, fog, high humidity, your gun could become an expensive club. And when the wind blew, it could blow the powder right out of the open pan. Just gone.
Oh, and then there's the issue of night operations.
What do you mean?
Well, the glowing match. It glows in the dark. Hundreds of soldiers with glowing matches. The enemy can see that from miles away. Any surprise attack was practically impossible.
Now you understand why the flintlock was developed later. But despite everything, the matchlock held on for an astonishingly long time.
Until the late 17th century, occasionally even into the early 18th. From 1704 onwards, the flintlock became standard everywhere. But before that, in the Livonian Wars, the matchlock was ubiquitous. The Battle of Ula in 1564, the Siege of Pskov in 1581-82,
and in the 30 Years' War, of course. 1618 to 1648, 30 years of carnage, with musketeers and their matchlocks right in the thick of it.
Also in the English Civil War, from 1642 to 1649, royalists fought parliamentarians, and both sides relied heavily on matchlock muskets.
That's almost 300 years of service, despite all the disadvantages.
Because it worked. Not perfectly, but reliably enough. And above all, simple. You can repair a matchlock in the field with basic tools.
And don't forget the smell. Hundreds of burning matches. The sulfur, the saltpeter. The battlefield must have stunk like hell.
Combined with the powder smoke from the shots. After a volley, you could barely see, let alone breathe.
Could the soldiers even still aim after the first round?
Often not really. That's why they fired in formation, volley fire. It's about volume, not precision. First row fires, moves to the back to reload, second row steps forward, and so on.
Almost like a machine. Load, aim, if you could see anything, fire, move back. And all that with a glowing match between your fingers.
Those were tough men. And the weapon they carried, despite all its flaws, was a real piece of engineering for its time.
So the serpentine certainly had bite. But eventually it became clear. There was room for improvement.
Now we come to the flintlock. This was really the next big step.
developed in the early 17th century to solve all the problems of the matchlock.
No more glowing match? No more moisture problems?
That was exactly the point. And the name that always comes up is Marin Le Bourgeois, a French gunsmith from Lisieux. He presented his system to the French king Louis XIII shortly after 1610 and...
Wait, was he really the inventor? Or did he more develop something further?
Good question. And historically speaking, yes, there were predecessors. The wheel lock, for example, where a toothed wheel rubbed against flint, similar to a lighter. And earlier experiments with flint and steel. But none of them were practical enough.
So Le Bourgeois perfected the system. He didn't invent it.
You could say he built the first working flint lock. His innovation included the half-cock position, a safety that let you load the weapon without it accidentally going off.
That sounds like a detail, but in the field, life-saving.
Right. And then the mechanism itself. You cock a spring mechanism. When you pull the trigger, the cock strikes the clamped flint against the frizzen. That's the metal plate that simultaneously covers the flash pan.
And from the strike?
The pan opens and sparks fly. They ignite the priming powder. A jet of flame shoots through the touch hole and boom! Main charge ignited.
That's elegant. One strike, two functions.
And the crucial advantage? The pan is covered until the shot. No rain, no wind blowing the powder away. The flintlock was weatherproof. Well, much more weatherproof than anything before.
That explains why the system was so successful. Developed in the early 17th century, but the matchlock remained in service for almost another 100 years. It only became truly standard around 1700. The famous Brown Bess came in 1722. And then another roughly 150 years of service.
The Napoleonic Wars, all flintlock. The system proved itself.
And what did a typical flintlock rifle look like? Were there differences?
Plenty. A good example is the Notthard rifle, M1801. It was already introduced at Jena and Auerstedt in 1806, but only about 20,000 were in circulation, almost exclusively with a guard. Most troops were still fighting with the old M1780-87. Still, the M1801 was a real advancement.
In what way?
A kilo lighter than its predecessor, caliber down from 18.5 to 15 millimeters, shorter barrel, and, for the first time on Prussian infantry rifles, a real sight with notch and bead.
A sight? They aimed without one before?
Before, you sighted along the barrel, roughly pointed in the direction and hoped. With a Notthard rifle, you could actually aim. That sounds obvious, but for the time it was revolutionary.
That changes the whole tactic. Precision instead of volume.
Although volley fire still dominated. But yes, a trained marksman could now hit something at 100 meters. And the lower weight made the difference on long marches.
And how long did the system last?
Until about the mid-19th century in various forms. Then the percussion lock replaced it. But we'll get to that.
So the flintlock was standard for over 200 years. Incredible when you think how fast technology develops today.
That shows how good the system was. Simple, robust, repairable in the field. The flint had to be changed every few dozen shots, but that was it. No wonder armies worldwide relied on it.
From Le Bourgeois' workshop in 1610 to the battlefields of Waterloo. That's quite impressive.
So the flintlock was a huge advancement. But it still had a problem. At least for a certain group of people.
Hunters?
And now, a quick word from our sponsor. Feeling curious? then head over to battlemerchant.com. They've got all sorts of medieval stuff, from costumes to armor and loads more. Totally worth a look.
Hunters. Because with a flintlock, at the moment of firing, there's a flash and a puff of smoke. Before the ball leaves the barrel, the game has already reacted.
And that's exactly where one of the, well, most unusual figures in weapons history comes in. Alexander Forsyth, a Scottish minister.
A minister?
A minister from Belhelvy in Aberdeenshire. The man gave sermons on Sundays and hunted passionately during the week. And he was tired of his ducks flying away before his shot arrived.
The motivation is understandable, but a clergyman as a weapons developer?
Forsyth was also a chemist. He experimented with various substances and discovered that certain compounds, fulminate of mercury, for example, explode on impact. No spark needed, no flash at the pan. The shot naturally still produces smoke, but the early warning for the game was gone.
And that became the percussion cap?
Forsyth laid the groundwork. The actual cap, as we know it, was then perfected by others. But the principle, a small metal cap filled with impact-sensitive primer. You place it on a nipple, the hammer strikes it, the charge explodes and directly ignites the main charge in the barrel. No more pan, no priming powder, no open flame.
That's more elegant than anything before. And faster.
The ignition delay was minimal. The game had no chance to react anymore. Forsyth had solved his problem and, incidentally, revolutionized weapons technology.
Which, of course, also interested the military, because the advantages didn't only apply to hunting. Less delay, less weather dependent.
And the weapons were used in some of the bloodiest conflicts of the 19th century. In the First Schleswig War from 1848 to
1851, and then of course the American Civil War, 1861 to 1865. Percussion was the dominant technology there.
The Lawrence rifle of 1854, for example, an Austrian model that was used en masse in the American Civil War. Or the American Springfield M1816, originally a flintlock, later converted en masse to percussion.
Converted? That was possible?
With many models, yes. You had to replace the ignition mechanism, but the rest of the weapon stayed the same. That was one of the advantages. You could modernize existing arsenals.
So no complete new purchase necessary?
The Italian Wars of Unification, 1859 and 1866, were largely fought with percussion weapons. Garibaldi's Red Shirts, the Austrian troops, all with this system.
But the percussion lock was eventually replaced too.
From the mid-19th century, the needle gun emerged. There, the primer was integrated directly into the cartridge, the next logical step. But the percussion principle lives on.
How so?
Well, look at modern cartridges. The primers in today's cartridges work on the same principle Forsyth developed. Impact-sensitive charge that ignites the main charge. The Scottish minister laid the foundation for everything that came after.
From frustrated duck hunting to modern ballistics, that's quite a story.
Sometimes it's the unexpected people who make the biggest leaps. A minister who wanted to hit his ducks and changed warfare in the process.
When you step back and look at the whole picture, 400 years of development, from the glowing match to the percussion cap.
Three systems, each an answer to the weaknesses of its predecessor. The match was practical, but gave you away at night. The flintlock was weatherproof, but the spark flash warned the game. And the percussion lock
solved both problems. No more match, no pan flash. There's muzzle flash with the shot, of course, but that comes with the bang.
What always fascinates me about this, these aren't abstract inventions. These were solutions to real problems by real people.
The musketeer in the 30 Years' War who had to protect his match from the rain. The hunter frustrated because his ducks flew away. A French gunsmith, a Scottish minister. People who weren't satisfied with what existed.
And that's exactly what makes living history so special. When you hold a flintlock musket today, a good replica, faithfully reproduced, you suddenly understand why the mechanism was designed that way. You feel the weight, hear the click of the cock, see the sparks.
That's something no book can convey. This tactile understanding, I'd call it. Hands-on history.
Although, of course, with functional replicas, you need...
responsibility. Absolutely. These aren't toys. Even though they are historical reproductions, they work on the same principles as the originals.
Anyone getting involved should know what they're doing. The technology, the safety rules, the history behind it. It all belongs together.
And that's also the beauty of it. You never stop learning. Every rifle has its history, every battle its context, every development its backstory.
And that's what makes this hobby so fascinating. You can trace this journey yourself.
For everyone who's now eager to dive deeper, at battlemerchant.com you find not only replicas and equipment, but also many more topics on history and living history in the blog.
From Viking swords to Napoleonic muskets, there's plenty to discover.
And with that, we've reached the end of our journey through the evolution of ignition mechanisms. I hope it fascinated you as much as it did us.
Until next time, and remember, history isn't just something you read. History is something you can experience.
Take care.
And so we ride towards the end of this episode. Keep your sword sharp and your mugs full. We'll catch you in the next one.